You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 121.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Hello, everyone. You've reached another Local Maximum, episode 121. Aaron, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Gotta love the palindrome episodes.
Slow news week.
Yeah, nothing happened once again. Everyone stayed home. The end, right?
I wonder, what's the last time we started an episode where we said slow news week, where it actually was a slow news week? Because I'm pretty sure there was one. But I don't know what it is.
I suppose technically we are in the slow television season. Because right back when calendars mattered, that was summer. All the SNL's gone home and all the regular television series are on break.
Now everyone's on break. Yeah,
but so, I mean, and that was in the before times when we didn't just get a full season dropped and binge watch it all at once. Thanks, Netflix. All right.
Well, before we get into some of the news, which is not all good news, I do have some good news for the podcast today, because today's episode has two sponsors. So people are really liking the show. And so I know a lot of people find value from the show. So I want you to listen to these and like check these out. First of all, if you work as a software engineer, particularly, you might be interested in continuous integration tools and to help yourself and help your company. And ActiveState has been making open source easier for developers to use and simpler for enterprises to adopt for more than 20 years. And they are currently looking to improve the state of the world with continuous integration and continuous deployment of their product line. And they have a survey that you can take that I will link at localmaxradio.com/121. Thrilled to have them as a new sponsor. Aaron, isn't this exciting? We're having sponsors now.
Yeah, we're moving on up.
Moving on up. Second, and these are great products, so I'm really excited. The second one, and this is relevant to everyone in the audience, that means you, the listener, this is Brilliant. They have an app and a website, brilliant.org. They have a fun interactive courses to help you beef up your skills in math and science. I'm telling you, it's like playing a video game, but instead you'll get smarter. So also localmaxradio.com/121. Amazing. And just like clockwork, I said that the 110s were about coronavirus. I think that we have reached the end of coronavirus news domination. Wouldn't you agree?
Certainly not the end of the coronavirus, but yeah, other stuff's happening, which I wouldn't say is completely independent of coronavirus.
No,
but it's diverging.
Okay,
paths
let's cut to the chase here, and I don't know how to say it, but this is the first episode, hopefully the last episode, where there are literally riots going on right behind me. Out the window, I don't really see it. I saw police cars going by, but really at the Barclays Center here, about three blocks away, Fort Greene, I'm just going to talk about my personal experience a little bit. The world doesn't need another take on this right now, because I've just been reading Twitter and Facebook, and there's too much information out there to sift through. I was walking around Friday night when this was when it supposedly started, and I didn't see anything. It was very quiet where I was. But I got back. I went to Connecticut over the weekend and got back today. Very peaceful protest near Barclays Center when I was walking around during the day. But the age of social distancing is definitely over. And then at nightfall, poof, I don't know. Look, I've been reading Twitter about some people say it's fine. Some people say all hell is breaking loose. I can't, we don't know until tomorrow, but, and people sift through this, but
yeah, it's hard to wrap your head around how isolated some of these pockets seem to be, that it's hyper-localized where it's happening, and you don't have to go far to almost be cocooned out of it, that you aren't aware it's happening, other than, you know, what's going on social media right now.
Yeah, no,
that,
I mean,
that could change, though.
In the building, it's scarier watching it on TV from Connecticut than it is actually being in the building here, which is really weird. But that's just the way it feels to be living in Brooklyn in 2020. I don't know what else to say. All the issues around it, I guess we'll slowly cover some of them in the next, in the Local Maximum as we go forward. If someone wants to come on the show and talk about what's going on, happy to talk to you. You might hear some sirens out there, although I find that, previously, like the fire trucks and ambulances are actually much louder than the police, so we don't hear that. We're probably not going to hear them as much. But anyway, these are crazy times. So ready to get into some. Oh, wait, before we get into the news story, I don't know if you listened to episode 120 and 119, but a lot of the statistical stuff that I've been doing, I've really enjoyed, including the Bayesian versus frequentist in 119 and some of the coronavirus stats that are either annoying me or coming out good in 120. So hopefully we'll kind of cycle back to that in the next few episodes.
Yeah. And I think there's going to be a lot more data of interest coming about as most states have moved into phase one or you know, phase 1.5 or 2.5 in their multi-step reopening plan. How things change in the face of that is going to provide hopefully some good insight into what we're really dealing with.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm hoping to just, you know, because we have a very technical show, a very product oriented show, I'm hoping to interview someone to talk about, you know, data graphic design, sort of the intersection between design and data presentation, data visualization.
Yeah. That would be fascinating because that's been a key piece of this from pretty much the beginning. Is nobody wants to look at formulas and boring Excel sheets. The effective communicators have been using some slick graphic design here.
Exactly. So very quick news article here. Twitter coming down hard on President Trump and Trump coming down hard on Twitter. They certainly do not like each other these days. They've always had this love-hate relationship because they kind of need each other in some ways. I think we could do a whole episode on this sort of stuff, and we have before. So this is just kind of updating you here. So Twitter has started flagging some of Trump's tweets. Some of them they flagged as inciting violence. Others they flagged as needing fact checking or being fact checked. There was one weird one about mail-in ballots that he was saying if we went to all mail-in, there'd be a lot of fraud. They're saying, no, it wouldn't be, but that's predictions about the future. So that's kind of a strange fact check. But in response, Trump directed the FCC to look at Section 230, which limits liability from defamation lawsuits for these online communities, which is in some ways people
did that
consider
come up in your episode with Naomi Brockwell?
So that was a little different. That was saying the government, and this was coming from Congress, they were going to limit liabilities. They were going to get rid of it unless you did what the government wanted in terms of encryption. So if you allow
backdoor encryption. It's the same lever, but being pulled in a different direction here.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's the exact same lever, but it sounds similar.
Yeah. I guess the FCC acting on it would be different than Congress acting on it.
Yeah, yeah. So, man, the government has, I mean, if there's one takeaway, the government has a lot of leverage over these, social media giants, which almost creates something of monopolistic conditions, which is not good.
Yeah, well, Section 230 is kind of a political mine. Well, it's a minefield at the intersection of politics and communication technology. And I guess one way to think of it is that we wouldn't be where we are today without it.
Yeah, it's like the lifeblood of the internet in some ways.
And depending on where you're standing and which way you're looking, that could be an amazing thing or the root of all evil here. That yeah, we don't get here from there without it, and that's not all good and it's not all bad.
Yeah. Oh, so one quote that I just pulled out here from law school professor Andrew Koppelman. President Trump wants to be able to disseminate falsehoods without those falsehoods being answered. It's hard to find a clearer violation of the First Amendment than that. So and I sort of agree, like these companies should be able to mark things up however they want. Of course, don't pretend that these companies are always going to be right in the way they mark things up. You know,
yeah.
Well, so the fact checkers will be wrong.
For the Twitter Luddites out there, which may just be me, but indulge me for a minute here. When you say
I wish so much, Aaron, that I could get off Twitter and Facebook. I've gotten off cable news, and I know that's made my life a lot better. I bet getting off Twitter and Facebook will. You've been off for a long time. Facebook is not even the Facebook that you were complaining about 5 years ago. It's much worse.
I'm glad to have jumped off that moving train when I did. But so when they flag a tweet, so for example, this one about the mail-in ballots, does that mean that it just has like a little sticky note next to it, or
yes.
they do you have to because I've seen sometimes when there's something that might be, you know, violent or disturbing in nature, they'll do the thing where they give you a warning and you have to click a button to actually see the tweet. Is it like that, or is it more they've just put a little little banner on it?
No, yeah, they put a little banner on it saying, like, you know, they'll put out his tweet on mail-in ballots and they'll be like, now learn the truth, click here, sort of a thing. You know, fact check, you know, get your facts here about this topic, something like that.
Because was it Medium that was doing, for anything remotely COVID related, they'd have the little banner on there that was basically, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there. Click here to get to our, like, you know, COVID dashboard for basically the endorsed material about it. We're not going to, well, I guess there were some cases of them not publishing stuff, but in general, they're not going to, you know, block the publishing of things, but they're going to paint everything that they haven't fact checked with the "this might not be fact checked" brush.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like when the president tweets it, they'll just put the sticky note, but maybe when someone else tweets it, they'll actually hide it. But
yeah, well, there's definitely
a double standard
with presidential tweets, and that's something that they've agonized over at length, and I'm sure we've talked about it on previous episodes about Twitter's kind of contortions of their policy in order to stand by that.
So Trump can respond to these. It's not like they just say, oh, that's not true, and then he's not allowed to write something underneath. Right. He totally is allowed to get into an argument with the fact checkers, but that's too much work. Come on. I'd love that. If one of my tweets got fact checked and I disagreed with the fact checker and I was having a Twitter fight with them, that would be a very interesting discussion.
Before we roll on past it, on the topic of mail-in ballots, I will disclose that I did drop off my mail-in ballot at the at town hall yesterday. So I've done my civic duty, and now I can ignore local politics until it becomes problematic again.
Yep. They're currently remarking up your ballot.
But I sealed it. I signed it and I sealed it.
I
managed not to get a paper cut.
Yeah, that's very dangerous going into the voting booth. I plan on voting in person if I can over the next few weeks, so wish me luck. If there is still a Fort Greene, I will be out and heading up.
Yeah. Well, so not a topic for today, but I'm going to throw this out there as something we might want to talk about in the future. If we do make the move to mail-in ballots or perhaps electronic voting not at the polling places, there certainly are ways that you can do that more securely. But I will venture that if we do move to mail-in ballots for the 2020 election, none of those enhanced security procedures will be able to be put in place given the timeline.
So yeah.
Gonna drop that there and move on.
Yeah. All right. So if you're like me, and this is to all the software engineers and tech employees in the audience, if you're like me, you're constantly thwarted and mystified by your build tools and your continuous integration tools at work as a software engineer or architect. I don't know if you face this, Aaron, but I face this everywhere at work. And there are some of you out there, some group of special people who are really great. You're really interested in improving internal tools at your company. We need you people because this stuff drives me crazy. I'm telling you, I'm so thankful for you people. So I want to tell you about ActiveState today. ActiveState has been making open source easier for developers to use and simpler for enterprises to adopt for more than 20 years. ActiveState helps enterprises scale securely with open source languages and gives developers the kinds of tools they love to use. More than 2 million developers and 97% of Fortune 1000 enterprises use ActiveState to support mission-critical systems and speed up software development while enhancing oversight and increasing quality. So they are inviting all of us to do a survey. I've done the survey. I'll tell you, you could take it if you work in software. If you're a programmer, developer, you can take it. If you're in, like, DevOps and architect, you definitely want to take this. So because I had to kind of look up, oh, what tools do we use at Foursquare? So I don't always know, but I was able to take it. And so it's to understand the state of integration and deployment tools at your company. So definitely check that out at localmaxradio.com/121. I'll link to it and check out their products as well. Maybe your company is due for a change in the continuous integration department, or if you just want to learn more about these tools because it's something every software shop needs today. All right, now we have another wonderful tech news story for you. I promise, Aaron, the positive one I think is coming at the end here. We just have one more that's a little bit...
I certainly hope so.
A 15-year-old steals $20 million in Bitcoin. And this is why I get paranoid when I deal with any of this stuff. You really have to be. So this is a 15-year-old high school student. He was 15 years old at the time. I think he's 18 now. In Westchester, Irvington, Westchester, I want to say something like that. It's near White Plains. You familiar with the area, Aaron?
I know where Westchester is, but I couldn't tell you any of the towns. For our not northeastern listeners, that's a county north of New York City.
It's, I assume, very similar to where we grew up in Connecticut. So just some kid riding around some suburban slash rural town, he's essentially doing heists and he's organizing lots of people.
He's not Bitcoin mining. He's literally stealing Bitcoin.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it doesn't in a second. But here's some of the quotes from an insider. An insider told the New York Post he would tell everyone what to do during the heists. He bragged about the Turpin robbery. That's the guy's name who he robbed, Turpin, who's a big-time investor and an early adopter of Bitcoin technology. So he bragged about the Turpin robbery being his job. He's a very smart guy and a control freak. If you piss him off, he would start texting you from weird numbers and threaten you. He'd call your parents and say weird things. So, I mean, I've seen people kind of verge on the edge of that. Have you ever dealt with someone who's gone crazy and has tried to contact you from a different number? Because I've seen that, but nothing to this extent.
Yeah, certainly not at that level.
Cointelegraph says, after Turpin's attorney contacted Pinsky's mother, that's got what Pinsky, what's his last name? Why did I not write their last
name? I assume that Pinsky was his last name.
His first name, Ellis Pinsky. Who was the Michael Turpin? Okay, I forgot to write their first name. So after Michael Turpin's attorney contacted Ellis Pinsky's mother, the teen sent $2 million in cryptocurrency and cash to the plaintiff and a $100,000 watch. However, made no admission of guilt. That is so weird.
It's odd that if in fact, and I haven't read the backstory here, if he stole the $20 million from Turpin, that he thought he could buy them off to make them go away with $2 million. I can't expect that the Turpin's going to be willing to take a 90% haircut on that.
Yeah, no. So Turpin has a lawsuit now for $71 million. Well, we'll see what happens, but it sounds like I don't want to, you know, this is all alleged. I got to say alleged, but if he's guilty, it sounds like a crazy situation where some sociopath kid thought he was never going to get caught.
I'm curious how he got caught. And also I want to make
a
note.
I read this.
You said this took place in, you said it was like 3 or 4 years ago.
3 years ago, I think.
Yeah. So I don't know if it took them a while to catch him or if it's just the wheels of justice turn very slowly. But
no, it's one of his accomplices got caught in another heist.
Ah.
So that's what happened. Yeah. He was 15. He had a 16-year-old accomplice. Yeah. He had a 16-year-old accomplice who he was always bullying, according to these articles. And then the 16-year-old turned him in.
There's some lesson to be learned there about employee satisfaction. and or leaving no witnesses. I don't know which is the takeaway
This is what scares me about today's world. Some kid is just going to come around and take everything from you. I don't know what to say.
So how did he do it?
Yeah, well, first of all, like, there are some pretty smart people in our high school, but I don't remember anyone who was coming close to doing anything like this.
Well, maybe they just didn't get caught.
That's maybe they were even smarter. That's true. You say that like it might be you. I'm getting a little concerned. So this is something to be to think about when it comes to your own security. He did this through something called SIM card swapping. So if you ever get a new iPhone, you go to the Apple store, you have this physical SIM card in your phone. They click it out and they usually take out your SIM card and put it in your new phone. It's like a tiny, I don't know, it's like a few millimeters across. And so that's sort of what attaches your identity to the phone. Now, SIM card swapping, to me at first it sounded like he was taking the SIM card out of your phone. I'm like, how do you get the guy's phone? No, they don't do that. You know, they don't actually swap your SIM card for another one. They simply call your carrier, like Verizon or AT&T, and they say, I've lost my phone or whatever, and they use some of your personal data that they get, and they convince them that they are you and to switch control of your phone number to themselves, the thieves. So it's been shown to be very insecure, which is kind of a surprising fact if you think about it. Like, you'd think that these companies like Verizon and AT&T would be better at, would have better processes for doing this, but apparently they do not.
Yeah, well, this is a classic example of social engineering that invariably the weakest link in any electronic system is a human.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, well, it's not just the human, though. The humans do require some information to prove that you're the person, but apparently not much. I don't know exactly what they require. So this is why oftentimes you have two-factor authentication. If you want something really secure, you have a password, and then you also have something on your phone, usually like a Google Authenticator app. But some of them use SMS.
Don't use SMS two-factor authentication for online banking. That's a big no-no.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oftentimes, like a lot of the credit card companies will have better checks on, hey, if you're taking out something, this kind of looks fraudulent. But yeah, definitely not a good idea. Rely on authentication, like Google authentication, that is based on data that is stored physically or just inside your phone as much as possible. Now, this is interesting dilemma here, because this is, I have a bunch of two-factor authentications. I have papers somewhere with all of my passwords to redo it on my phone. When I got a new phone, some of my two-factor authentications from work, I didn't copy over. I didn't have the data, and I had to go to help desk at work. And this is when the pandemic was just firing up, and it was a real pain in the neck. And so I'm sort of worried about the average person being able to do this properly.
Yeah, that's been a mild concern for me as well, because I've moved to almost exclusively, and this isn't specifically on the two-factor side, but I've done it for that as well. I use a password manager that I primarily interface with on my phone, and then access to that password manager requires two-factor authentication, for which I use a one-time password generator on my phone. So if I physically, if my phone falls in the toilet and dies, I don't actually know any of my passwords anymore, since they're,
Oh, that's scary.
20-something characters long and totally random. There are some things
have paper backups of
some key pieces so that you can kind of unlock your master password again. But it does make you dependent on what could potentially be a single point of failure there, that it gives you much greater security in moving away from easily guessable passwords. But you want to be careful that you don't accidentally put yourself in a position where you've locked yourself out of that information. Or conversely, if your phone physically gets stolen, you want to make sure that's not enough to completely steal your identity with it there too, because phones do get stolen.
This is still, I think, an active area for entrepreneurship, because there are companies like 1Password and stuff like that to keep your password safe and two-factor authentication. But I don't think there's still got to be some clever my gut's telling me there's got to be some clever ways to crack this and get this much more secure than it is. Because again, there are good ways to secure things, but it's the human that's the problem. And especially if you want the average person dealing with their security to deal with it well, I think it's going to be tough. And it's not just people who have Bitcoin. It's not just people who have cryptocurrency. The SIM card swapping, this can do a lot of damage to anyone.
Yeah, well, and in a world where we hopefully move away from the Googles and the Amazons and whoever having all this metadata on us, that maybe we can move to where we personally control that information more, then having good security on that is going to become even more important.
All right, so one of the challenges that I have on this show is describing all of these rich probabilistic concepts like Bayesian inference and overfitting and underfitting and priors, and trying to describe them in an audio format. Wouldn't you agree that's tough sometimes?
Yeah, you got to paint a picture, and not always easy to do that.
All right. Well, we're going to keep trying to do that on the Local Maxim, but I want to tell you about a new sponsor that I'm really excited about. Or actually, this is the second time doing it, but they're still a new sponsor. I checked out some of their courses recently, and I think that you should check it out too. It's called Brilliant. It's not like other online courses. You're not going to have to sit through long videos and download PDFs. It's very visual. It's an interactive way to learn concepts in math, probability, and science. And I always say this, the most important part of learning a new concept is to be able to get a good intuition for it, to understand what it means and what's going on. I talked about the pitfalls of memorization a few episodes ago, as you recall. So if you want to dive deeper and actively learn some of the concepts that I've introduced here in the Local Maximum, whether it's logic or probability, or all the way to something like group theory or quantum mechanics, go to brilliant.org or the app. It's a great way to go. And, you know, I know I have a bunch of things to brush up on. Aaron, you checked it out for like a minute, right? I'm going to have to send you more so you could tell us about your experience when you come back.
Yeah, well, so I was looking through some of the course offerings, and one that caught my eye speaks to our next topic a little bit. But they've got in their classical mechanics section, they've got a little dynamics bootcamp series of courses. And under the momentum section, they have a lesson on the rocket equation. So sneak peek, you know where we're going next.
Yeah, and I certainly need to learn about some of this stuff. So I'm definitely going to check this out. So you want to go to brilliant.org/localmaximum. The first 200 people who do it will get 20% off membership to Brilliant. That's a pretty good deal. Remember, it's called Brilliant. You can take the courses on their website or their app, so you can get it on your phone and your tablet. But remember to sign up and go directly to brilliant.org/localmaximum to get the discount, or find my link at localmaxradio.com/121. All right, so this means we're going about to into space, which seems to be the only good thing going on over the last few days.
To find some good news, we have to leave the Earth.
Yeah, well, what was it? There was a tweet that I was reading, and it was like, congratulations to the astronauts who left Earth today. Good choice. I thought that kind of summed it up. But the astronauts who left Earth in 1969 and landed on the moon, I don't think that everything was going on that day, but it was still a very crazy few years at the time. I want to cover this as part of our kind of emerging technology series, and this is SpaceX. This is Elon Musk's company. This is the first launch in the United States since 2011. I don't know if you remember, do you remember when they retired the shuttle? I think that was in 2011.
I do. Yeah. Yeah. It is one of my great regrets that I didn't make the road trip down there to actually watch a shuttle launch before they shut down the program.
Well, now you could watch another launch.
Yeah.
I remember being at the Foursquare office in 2012 when they took the space shuttle to the Intrepid in New York. And I believe I saw, I don't know, I remember seeing it coming through the harbor. I don't know if it was on TV or if it was out a window. It was one of those two. Maybe I saw it both, but I'm pretty sure I actually saw it, not like live up and close in person. I wasn't like at the river, but I remember being in some building and watching it you know, at the window, I could see like a small, like I could see the space shuttle in the distance being, or did I see it being flown in? Was it flown in or was it boated in? I think it was flown in. I think I saw it being flown in.
I would say, I'm sure they couldn't have flown it onto the aircraft carrier, but they...
I think I saw it being flown on top of a plane. It was really cool.
Yeah, it was designed for that way because they do not land, or they did not land the space shuttle where they launch it from. So they needed a way to transport it across the country.
Yeah. So what's notable in this launch over this last weekend, it's certainly not, it's notable. It's certainly not, you know, the Apollo 11 notable, but it's notable. This is a commercially made spacecraft, commercially made spacesuits that look so different. They look much cooler. They're sleeker. They're more stylish. And so this is the private space race. The private space race has begun, probably more accurately kind of a public-private partnership, but still it's sort of a new era in space travel. I would have expected it to be kicked off right now. By now, there's been a lot of setbacks in the private space industry, but looks like it's not going away.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mutually beneficial situation here, because not only is Elon Musk's SpaceX getting a significant amount of government funding to somewhat defray the cost of the development of the Dragon capsule and the Falcon Heavy, they're also providing this capability to the government at a dramatic fraction of the cost that it's taking the traditional industry partners such as your Boeings to develop equivalent capability, and not only is it cheaper, but those guys haven't actually done it yet. So I'm not going to say that this is, you know, a completely private endeavor, in that there was certainly government funding there.
Oh, far from it, yeah.
And there aren't that many people, you know, lining up to launch humans into space for private commercial purposes right now. But we're a huge step closer to that today than we were previously. It's a big step in that direction.
That's certainly where they want to go. They also have a competitor.
And their objective is not simply to be a government contractor. They're very much looking beyond that. So I don't think, you know, your Boeings and your Northrops and your Lockheeds are really particularly interested in pursuing the commercial/civilian space market. They're much more interested in serving the military/government NASA market. So there's a dramatically different focus on the structure of the business, and as a result, the solutions that they're bringing to the table.
Yeah, private's going to be so interesting. Because I want to talk a little bit about the Virgin, which is like Virgin Galactic, and now there's Virgin Orbit too. So they have two companies doing space, if I am to understand correctly. So I've been following Virgin Galactic for a long time because, you know, way back in what was it like when they had Spaceship One in like 2005 or something like that? Was that that was one of those prizes? So they've been at this for a long time. They recently had a failed test of something called Launcher One. This is from Virgin Orbit from the Mojave Spaceport. But they're still in the game. They're still working for it. So their business in terms of that, in terms of Virgin Orbit, is going to be launching small satellites, private satellites, into space for a nice price.
They're kind of a fascinating approach. It's a very different engineering design than your Blue Origin or your SpaceX. They're literally strapping a rocket onto, I believe it's a 747. And they fly it up to altitude, and then they drop it off of the airplane. It sits under the wing, kind of like a ginormous missile.
So the one we saw, and I saw the video
afterwards.
Yeah, the video that I saw, it was just the rocket goes straight up, and then after it detaches, it comes right back down to where it is, which is amazing. And so the one you're talking about with Virgin, it takes off horizontally.
Yeah, which I think when I was rereading about it this past week to watch that to follow along to the launch test, they mentioned they have much more demanding gimbal requirements for their engine, because unlike a vertical launch, where you need to make some slight adjustments in the vectoring of your thrust. With a horizontal launch, you need a much greater range of motion for that main engine. So that they gain a lot of capability by not having to use the rockets to lift it the first, whatever it is, 30,000 feet. But it does introduce some new challenges to them. And full disclosure, I did have some professional involvement with Virgin Orbit back in 2015, 2016, through the company I work for their Launcher One product. And I'm not directly working with them now, but I've certainly been following them closely since at least that far back.
So yeah, very cool. So what are the capabilities that you think they gained by doing the horizontal launch?
It's not so much that they gained by doing the horizontal. It's that the rocket equation kind of gets to it. The most demanding, the most costly part of your launch is the first section, and
the rocket equation. If I am to understand this correctly, the rocket equation tells you how big the rocket you need to leave Earth. Is that what it is?
That's what it boils down to. Is, you know, to get this much weight to this orbit, how much fuel do you need? There's a rule of thumb, and it obviously there are a lot more detailed variables in there, but it's something like, for a traditional rocket launch, 90% of your mass on takeoff is fuel. Because not only do you have to bring all your cargo and you know, the shell of the rocket and the engines, but you got to bring all the fuel. And the more fuel you put in the tanks, the more fuel you need to lift the fuel you just put in the tanks. So by cutting off the first, even if it's only, you know, 5% of the altitude, that's the most expensive 5% for them.
I understand. So like any fuel that you put in at the beginning, you're going to have to if half the fuel is used halfway up, I know that's not exact, but like then the other half of the fuel has to be carried by that first half, that whole layup.
It's a classic differential equation problem, and that's why you see you saw in the SpaceX launch, they use staged rockets. So that was I think it was a two-stage rocket, and then on top of the second stage was the Dragon capsule. It's because once you use up all the fuel in the first stage, you want to dump all the weight of the first stage, so you're not dragging that along for the rest of the trip.
Yeah. So Virgin Galactic had, and Virgin Galactic is a little different, but they both do horizontal launches. They had a big accident back in 2014. And I believe at the time they kept being like a couple more years. At one point they were like in 18 months, Branson is like, I'm going to be on this thing. And that accident really set them back big, didn't it?
Yeah, that was a huge blow, and I believe they lost at least one of their test pilots in that. So that was a big deal, and they were kind of leading the pack at that point because they'd done a bunch of, I think, suborbital flights, and while they were not necessarily sidelined, but while they had to go back to the drawing board and rethink how they were approaching the problem to make sure that doesn't happen again. We saw SpaceX and to a lesser extent Blue Origin close the gap now that SpaceX has put humans into orbit, that's the big benchmark there.
So and this is really interesting now that you have multiple companies, you have an industry, you have, from what I understand, you know, they're competing over talent, over engineering talent, just like, you know, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's one of the big things we noticed when I was on site there in 2015, 2016. It seemed like at least half the people you spoke to were former SpaceX people. Whether that's because they jumped ship or because they were stolen away or just there's a lot of... I mean, you see that to a certain extent in Silicon Valley, that the big tech companies, there are a lot of people kind of hopping around between them.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That was the analogy I was making. So yeah, 2000s saw a lot of hope with Spaceship One. The space industry had many failed promises in the 2010s, although Elon Musk's did have a very cool launch back in 2015. But we did have the loss of the shuttle program. Perhaps this is a sign that we are turning the corner now. Maybe the 2020s will see more successful private space launches.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. It would be a kind of a not a moral boost, but this country needs some good news right now, and if we can mark up some wins in that column, that's something. On the other side of that coin, we did have in the last, I don't know if it was this week or the week before, the release of Space Force, Steve Carell comedy. So that's going in a little bit of a different direction, but
that actually sounds like it's pretty funny.
Some of the reviews have not been super enthusiastic with it, but I've watched the first two episodes and I will be watching more. So it's at least that good.
Okay, that says something. I just remember Steve Carell and he's in Get Smart. He was in a lot of things that I liked, but the Get Smart kind of reminds me of the vibe that I'm thinking for Space Force.
This may be a little bit of that.
It's just a silly.
It's completely off topic, but did you ever watch the original Get Smarts? The black and whites?
I mean, I might have seen clips of it.
I remember watching those as a kid, like at my grandma's house. And man, I went back and rewatched some a few years ago. They have not aged well in the sense that, man, political correctness was not a thing in that time period.
Definitely. Have you seen the first Star Trek ones in the 60s?
I've seen a couple of the episodes, but other than the fact that Captain Kirk always gets lucky, I don't remember much detail.
I think it was the pilot episode or some of them, when they were like, oh, you can't let women onto the bridge. It's really bad. I mean, they were trying to.
Well,
be,
and at the time, they were groundbreaking in that they had a multi-gender, multi-racial crew. That was almost scandalous.
Yeah, and they were trying to show they were maybe trying to show the closed-mindedness of the captain with statements like that. But it's
still
almost like it looks so. It sounds so weird now. It is weird how the entertainment that is meant to be culturally progressive sometimes ages the worst after 40, 50 years.
To bring it back a little bit, and I can't remember if you said it right or not, but I know there is a concerted effort going on. To use the proper terminology at NASA right now, is that they are human missions, human space flight.
Okay.
I can get behind that. It's easy to slip back into referring to them as manned missions, but that is
right.
That is not the proper term for the day. So I will endeavor to use the correct terminology there, I see a bright future for human space flight and robotic space flight in tandem with it.
All right. Well, we had the human mission today, or this past week. In the U.S., the Trump administration, I'm sure he's not the only one who wants this, they want a human mission to the moon by 2024. So this would be a huge deal if it happens. I hate to be, now I'm like, huge deal, huge deal. But, you know, big win. It sounds so silly now. But hey, Metaculus has this as maybe a 20% chance of happening, of somebody landing on the moon. And if that happens, that would be a huge deal. I mean, someone landing on the moon in 69 was a big deal, but it has not happened in our lifetimes since,
the 70s. Early 70s was the last Apollo flight.
So the first one was the 69, so that's like two and a half years? How much? Yeah. So, this is,
I think there were only five missions. There's another related question to that I don't know off the top of my head what the wording on it is, but it's something about, you know, will by the date 2030 or 2040, will there be more people who've landed on the who are alive that have landed on the moon, you know, since 2020 or from before? Because we've got, you know, there's a fixed number who landed in the Apollo program, and they're slowly being lost to time. Will will we be able to get back there? And once we do, how quickly will we ramp it up? Is it going to be kind of a one and done, prove we did it again?
So wait.
Or are we actually going to be able to establish a moon base and have regular transit back and forth?
So I understand. But what was the actual the score system, the prediction? Was
I'm going to have to see if I can find that one. Yeah.
Okay. Is the same number of people before versus after? I was a little confused.
Yeah, I'm not doing it justice, but give me a minute and I will seek it out. Well, so there's one for when will the next human being walk on the moon?
So there's a will it happen by 2024, and that there's a 20% chance of. But then there's a
It looks like the community consensus right now is at September of 2031. Yeah.
Well, that's a long time. I don't want to wait that long.
It's possible that I'm mixing up questions here because I'm not seeing it in the space section under Moon. But there's an interesting one about when will Mars? Oh, that's Mars. I thought there was a Moon one about that. Oh, yeah. Will Mars have a permanent population of 10,000 before the Moon does? That's an interesting one.
So you might understand this more than me, but it seems like the Moon would have a big population before Mars does, just because it's so much easier to get to. But what's the counter argument to that?
I think it's a question of what can you do there? Do you need 10,000 people on the
moon? What can you do in any of those places? It's a desolate, both are desolate planets. I mean, the moon's not a planet, but you know what I mean? Desolate planets that do not support life and are miserable to be in. And what are their, precious metals or something we could bring back? I mean, it'd be too expensive.
It wouldn't so much be
for
bringing
it
back, but I feel like the advantage of numbers would be bigger by having, you know, more people to do more stuff on Mars than on the moon.
Well, you need to have an economy.
And because with the moon, you can and you'd still live easily transit back and forth. So do you need that many people there permanently? But
right.
Yeah. Okay, a lot of open questions there.
All right. Cool. Well, I always like talking about this topic and learning something new about space. Certainly that launch was, even though happening during an interesting week, during an interesting few months, I mean, people are going to be looking back at that launch and seeing all of the people in the control room with their masks and being 6 feet apart. And people will be asking, oh, why is that happening? Oh, this was during that pandemic. Huh. Who knows how future generations will look at that. But that would be, because I wouldn't be surprised if I was looking at something in World War I and saw people in masks. Oh, yeah, that pandemic that I barely knew about. So something like that. But it's really crazy. But I'm glad that we had this piece of news come out this week.
Yeah, and it went as smooth as they could have possibly hoped for. So it's nice to see things go right for once.
Yeah, we know that doesn't always happen with space. All right, so next week, I don't have a specific plan for next week yet, but I do have a few plans. Like I said, I want someone in to talk about data visualization, which I think is really important these days. I'm going to try to have a series on the Electoral College, given that the presidential race is coming up, and I'm going to try to approach it from more of a social choice angle. So I'm going to talk about the mathematical properties of the Electoral College. But then I'm going to interview someone who wrote a book about it, who's defending the Electoral College. And I may even get to interview an elector who was in the Electoral College about their experiences. So this will be an interesting series. Also try to get to more technical topics in the next few weeks. So look out for that. Aaron, I hope thanks for joining me at this late hour, this crazy week. And I hope you'll join me again for another Local Maximum. All right. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account at Max Sklar. Have a great week. Feel the power.